From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new movie Undercover Brother is a satire of black action films of the 70s. It also takes on current black and white racial stereotypes. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with screenwriter John Ridley. He based the screenplay on a web animated series he created. Ridley also has a new novel about an African-American comic trying to make it in the 60s. He opens for the Rat Pack in Vegas and becomes the first black comic on The Ed Sullivan Show. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews a new CD of outsider music, Songs in the Key of Z. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal officials are holding a man they say was part of an al-Qaeda plot to detonate a dirty bomb in the United States. Abdullah al-Muhajir is an American citizen who was arrested last month in Chicago after arriving on a flight from Pakistan. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
U.S. officials say Muhajir met with al-Qaeda leaders several times last year in Pakistan and Afghanistan. They say he received training in wiring explosives and researched the use of dirty bombs, which spread radioactive material when they're detonated. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced the arrest, saying that the U.S. has evidence that Muhajir was part of a plot to build and set off a dirty bomb in the U.S. U.S. officials say the plan was in its early stages, and it's not clear what the target would be. Muhajir is an American citizen, a former Chicago gang member named Jose Padilla, who converted to Islam in the mid-1990s. He's been held since May 8th, when he was arrested at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. President Bush designated Muhajir an enemy combatant and transferred him from Justice Department to Defense Department custody. He was moved from New York to a naval prison in Charleston, South Carolina. Greg Allen, NPR News, Washington.
Moroccan officials say they've arrested three Saudi men who were planning to carry out suicide attacks on U.S. and British ships in the Straits of Gibraltar. The officials, who declined to be identified, told wire services that the men were members of the al-Qaeda terrorist network. The officials said the men were arrested in Morocco last month. The U.S. blames Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda group for the attack that killed 17 American sailors aboard the USS Cole in Yemen in October of 2000. President Bush met with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today. Both leaders said the time was not yet right for reviving the Mideast peace talks. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Sharon repeated his refusal to hold peace talks until all Palestinian violence ends, and he signaled again that he would not negotiate with Yasser Arafat, at least for now. "We don't have a partner," he said. "We hope we will have." President Bush repeated his disappointment with Arafat and called for reforms to make the Palestinian Authority financially transparent and bound by the rule of law. The two men met hours after Israeli tanks again encircled Arafat's compound in the West Bank, but instead of criticizing such moves, as he's done before, Mr. Bush invoked Israel's right to defend itself. Arab leaders have been pressing Mr. Bush to get more involved in peacemaking, but this weekend he rejected any timetable for Palestinian statehood and asked today about a possible U.S.-hosted Mideast conference. President Bush said conditions are not right. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 55 points to close at 9,645 in heavy trading of 1.2 billion shares. NASDAQ Composite Index lost 5 points. It closed at 1,530. This is NPR News. Authorities in Denver are calling for the evacuation of hundreds of people as winds drive a big wildfire toward the edge of the city. Douglas County, near Denver, said it's evacuating 1,500 people. The Forest Service says the fire is already within 10 miles of residential neighborhoods. Fire authorities have pulled their firefighters off the front lines because the fast-moving blaze is too dangerous. A new report from state air pollution control officials says emissions from diesel machinery, such as bulldozers and tractors, cause thousands of avoidable premature deaths each year. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
The Environmental Protection Agency has tough new regulations for diesel trucks, but a group of state air pollution officials says more pollution comes from diesel-powered construction and farm equipment. State officials are urging the EPA to set new engine and fuel standards to cut these emissions. Officials say simply changing the types of fuel used in diesel machinery would result in immediate reductions of emissions known as particulates. Past studies have linked exposure to particulates to elevated risks of lung disease and premature death. The Bush administration says it will work with the Office of Management and Budget to write new regulations by early next year. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Former New York crime boss John Gotti has died from throat cancer. He was 61. Gotti died at a prison hospital in Springfield, Missouri. Gotti had served almost 10 years of a life sentence for racketeering and murder. Before he was convicted in 1992, Gotti was known as the Teflon Don because authorities were never able to make any criminal charges stick to him. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Golf Channel, featuring special U.S. Open programming and pregame coverage live from Bethpage, New York, tonight starting at 7 p.m. Eastern on the Golf Channel.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The black action films of the 70s are affectionately satirized in the new film Undercover Brother. The movie also takes on some of the preconceptions that blacks and whites have of each other today. My guest John Ridley is one of the film's screenwriters. The screenplay was adapted from his web-based animated series Undercover Brother. Ridley also has a new novel about an African-American comic in the 60s. We'll get to that a little later. Undercover Brother stars Eddie Griffin as an action hero stuck in the 70s with his gold Cadillac, leather suit, platform shoes, and huge afro. He teams up with a group called the Brotherhood that is fighting a white villain known as the Man. The Man has devised a plot to prevent a popular African-American politician from becoming president. Here's Undercover Brother making his first appearance at the Brotherhood after learning about this political conspiracy.
So the conspiracies we believe for all these years are really true? The NBA really instituted the three-point shot to give white boys a chance?
Absolutely.
So the entertainment industry really is out to get Spike Lee. Is that right?
Come on, man. Even Cher got an Oscar.
Cher! And O.J. really didn't do it.
Let's just move on, shall we?
Later in the film, Undercover Brother disguises himself as a thoroughly assimilated, preppy black man in order to get close to one of the Man's most sinister operatives, a sexy young white woman known as White She-Devil. He gets very close with her, intimate, in fact. When he next meets with the members of the Brotherhood, he's almost unrecognizable. He's got short hair, round tortoiseshell glasses, a sweater tied around his shoulders, and he's drinking a guava mango broccoli smoothie. The Brotherhood is trying to figure out why he looks and sounds so strange.
White girl or no white girl, I want to know, where the hell have you been?
Not there, because that's where people who swear go.
Thank you very much. You sound like a 14-year-old white chick.
I don't think so, sister girl.
It's sister girl, dude.
Maybe on Planet Ebonics, but where I come from, we like to pronounce our E's and our R's. Thank you very much. Now, maybe you guys don't like the new me, but I don't give a gosh darn. For all I care, you can all get the bejeebies out of here. Now, if you'll excuse me, I must be going. Frasier's on.
The film and the web versions of Undercover Brother intersected in a funny way in the movie's casting. One edition of the web version of Undercover Brother is about the conspiracy that's keeping black shows off of television. It raises the question, why have all the really good black shows with all the great black actors disappeared, while many of the current black shows are broad and stereotypical and often embarrassments to African Americans? One of the shows used as an example as an embarrassment to African Americans is Malcolm and Eddie. One of the stars of that show, Eddie Griffin, is the star of the movie version of Undercover Brother. I asked John Ridley how Griffin got that role.
It's weird because there were a lot of comedians or black comedians or comedic actors who I thought would be really good for the part, who I thought had a real edge to them, were really frightened about doing the material as a movie, because now as they move from being comedians on stage to being stars, you know, they want to be accepted by a very broad audience. And even though they were kind of edgy and might talk about some similar issues that we had in Undercover Brother on stage, they thought, or at least the feeling that they communicated, was that, oh, I don't want to play this character, you know, audiences might not like me, or this and that, or the material is a little bit too edgy. And I was really shocked and surprised. And what I really liked about Eddie was that he wasn't afraid of the material. He wasn't afraid of the fact that we went after race relations in America. He wasn't afraid of being political. He wasn't afraid of doing a movie that at least attempted to raise the bar in terms of what's going on just in comedy in general. I mean, today teen comedies tend to be, you know, very scatological and have a lot of, you know, humor that deals with bodily functions, and we don't have any of that in Undercover Brother. And so immediately I really admired Eddie for wanting to go after this role, A, because I did make a joke about his TV show, and B, because he was not afraid of the material. And then once he got the part, he really embraced it, and he really worked hard to put together a performance and not just be a stand-up comedian being filmed away from a stage and on a set, but to be a true comedic actor.
When adapting Undercover Brother for a movie, did you change the humor at all, thinking, well, it has to reach a much larger audience, so more people have to get the jokes, so that the references and the jokes have to be different?
Well, I didn't want to, and I avoided it as much as humanly possible. Anytime you write a script, there are any number of changes that take place on a conceptual level or because of budget or time constraints. But for me, I felt like, and I do still feel like, that in our society right now, in terms of entertainment, there isn't a lot of entertainment that's very pointed or very political. You know, I look at this film, and in some ways I think it's great that we're talking about race, that we're joking about race, that we're saying it's not such a big deal. But you look back at, like, films, say, like Blazing Saddles or television shows like All in the Family, where race was always a topic, it was always joked about, it was frank and it was satirical at the same time, and we just don't see that much anymore. And I think in some ways it's kind of disappointing. I think a lot of ways television and films, they really don't confront things that are political issues in a humorous, insightful way. I think a lot of times it's better to go at a topic with humor. It relaxes people, and people can deal with it a little bit better when it's not so serious.
Undercover Brother is in part an homage to the black action films of the 70s. Which were the ones that were big when you were coming of age?
Well, when I was coming of age, there were, I guess, two groups. They were the really bad blaxploitation films, films like Blackula and Scream, Blackula, Scream. I actually remember going to see Scream, Blackula, Scream with my dad because I just loved the title so much. I just thought, you know, Blackula is such a, it's such a wonderful title. It's so evocative. How can you not enjoy that? But I also remember, and I remember especially seeing some really quality black films like Sounder, Bingo Long, The Traveling All-Stars, The Man. I remember seeing a very powerful film. My parents really wanted me to see that. It was about the first black man to become president of the United States of America. James Earl Jones was the star of it. And an incredibly powerful film in terms of the issues that it dealt with. There was a black man, and it was George Sanford Brown, who's this radical who ends up shooting a politician in South Africa during apartheid. He escapes to the United States, and he asks James Earl Jones, the black president, for asylum. And at the end of the film, James Earl Jones sends this black guy back to South Africa to face his crimes. Now, that's incredibly powerful for a blaxploitation film, which is supposed to be a very strong statement about blackness, not letting George Sanford Brown stay in the United States, but saying you have to go back and face your crimes. I thought that was an incredible statement, a very brave one, because it took a chance at perhaps alienating its very audience, a black audience, but saying, you know what, we have to do what's right. And no matter how much we're oppressed or people put us down, we still have to stand up to a higher moral ground. It was a great film.
Now, you grew up in a pretty middle-class suburban neighborhood.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy all the action heroes that would be decked out in these really wild big hats and red suits and platform shoes and fancy cars and selling drugs and being pimps and all
the pimp image,
all
the
stuff.
The pimps. Yeah. You know, it's my parents wouldn't let me go. I was too young at the time, so my parents wouldn't let me go see movies like Superfly or Black Caesar or films like that. So I wasn't really inundated with much of the pimp image actually later in life. It's ironic that most of the pimp images that I got were from mainstream television, you know, on Starsky and Hutch, they had Huggy Bear, and on Beretta, they had a, I don't remember the name of the character, but they had a pimp character. So it's actually was the mainstream media that introduced me to these images of black culture, and they were very limited. They were saying black guys, you know, they play pimps, and they play street people, and they play thugs, and I think, you know, that... You know, later in life, it became a lesson to me because a lot of the images I had about black America, having grown up in a predominantly white suburb, were what I got from television, and they were very stereotypical images. So I'm very careful in this day and age when I write for television and write for movies to try to portray black characters in a balance as much as possible. And it's amazing, even today, there are a lot of people in Hollywood, and they're not bad people, they're not bigots or racist by any means. But because all of us in Hollywood live in a very myopic society, go to the same restaurants, live in the same gated communities, we have a very narrow focus on what's going on in the rest of America, whether it's black people or white people or young or old or thin or fat or what have you. So I'm very careful to try to portray characters in a very broad-based fashion, to try not just to have iconic or stereotypical images in the things that I write.
Since your parents didn't want you to see Superfly and other movies like that, did they become even more exciting when you did get to see them?
Well, you know, the problem is when I finally got to see these movies, and some of them, you know, very much later in life now that, you know, DVD and video are big, and a lot of these movies are just now recently, like Coffee and Friday Foster are just now coming out on video or on DVD. I was actually kind of disappointed when I finally saw him because, you know, you grow up hearing about these things and how cool Superfly is and how cool all these characters are. And you finally see all these films in their entirety and they just don't hold up in terms of their quality, in terms of the writing and things like that. But I enjoy them because they are just, they're such throwbacks and they're such kitsch. I mean, I love two of my favorite blaxploitation films. Black Belt Jones with Jim Kelly, which is really a hoot to watch. They have a big karate action fight scene at the end in a car wash where all these soap suds are, and everybody's coming out of the soap suds fighting each other, and I'm sure at the time it seemed like a really cool end scene. And then Three the Hard Way, which is Jim Brown, Jim Kelly, and Fred the Hammer Williamson as these three tough black guys taking on the man one more time. And these are they're just so much fun. You cannot help but enjoy these films.
My guest is John Ridley. He co-wrote the screenplay for the new film Undercover Brother. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Ridley, co-wrote the screenplay for the new film Undercover Brother. It's based on an animated web-based series that he created. It satirizes black action films of the 70s and racial stereotypes of today.
I think that you were, when you went to high school, one of the few African-American students in the school. Did you have a sense of how the white students saw you as an African-American, if you were typed as being any particular way, as being... you know, like more hip or more...
Yeah, one way or the other.
More one way or another. Yeah, exactly.
No, you know, the weird thing is because I grew up in a small community, I never had any really... I never really had any problems with how I was perceived as a black person versus the rest of the white kids. I got along very well with everybody. Everyone treated me very well. A lot of people in the neighborhood, most of the people, they knew our parents. I had two sisters. They were also in school with me. They knew that my father was a doctor, my mother was a teacher. And because I lived in an environment where people really knew each other, people didn't come at us with presuppositions or stereotypes about how we should act or how anyone in my family should act. And I think that was sort of the weird thing about growing up in a small town in Wisconsin. It was a place where you might think there'd be a lot of bigotry, but there wasn't much at all. When I went to New York in the 80s, it was a time of, you know, Bernie Goetz and Howard Beach. That's when I really got hit with a lot of racism, and it was put very much in my face about how black people and white people really thought about each other. And it was very strange in a city that you'd think would be exceptionally cosmopolitan. It was actually the reverse, because people don't really know each other very well, and they don't talk to each other as much as perhaps they think they do. and therefore they do carry around a lot of baggage, as opposed to where I grew up, where people just knew me as John Ridley, and that was it.
How did it change your behavior to know that people around you might be suspicious of you merely because you were African-American? You know, when you came from a place where you could be unselfconscious. Unselfconscious about race, anyways. I'm sure there are plenty of things you were self-conscious about.
Yeah, when you're a teenager in high school, there are plenty of things
to be self-conscious about.
Race was not one of them. It was very strange because, you know, you would hear things about being black in America, about, you know, walking into a store and having employees follow you around to make sure that you weren't stealing things, or that when you try to hail a cab, a lot of cab drivers wouldn't stop for you. You hear these things, you think of them as being stereotypical concepts in and of themselves about how people are treated, and you don't think much about it. And then I went to New York, and I would find these things happening to me. I'd find if I went into a store, for example. I remember going into a store once with another friend of mine who's a black guy, really big, tall black guy, and he was buying, I think, some jewelry for his mom for her birthday. And we went in the store, and one of the employees, it was a fairly small kind of storefront jewelry store right off the street, and one of the employees locked the door behind us and stood by the door so that we couldn't, you know, grab some jewelry and go running out of the store. And it was very weird. My friend pointed that out to me and said, "Did you see what they did when we were in there?" And it was an education for me, because I'd heard about things like this, and you think, well, maybe they're isolated incidents, or we as black people sometimes blow them out of proportion. And I'm not saying, you know, sometimes maybe we do, but it does happen far more often than I think a lot of people would really believe themselves if it didn't happen to them.
Now, getting back to Undercover Brother, because of the whole like dual identity, undercover nature of this, and because it started off as a cartoon, an animation on the internet, I'm wondering if you were a big fan of comic books when you were growing up.
Oh, huge. Huge fan of comic books. The first thing I can remember reading as a kid, and not even reading because I was so young, I couldn't read at the time, but they were comic books. My parents used to give them to me, and just the visual images and the color and the fanciful nature of comic books was such an indelible image in my mind as a child. I love them, and even to this day, I still go to the comic book stores every Wednesday. Wednesday is the day when new comics come out, and I grab them up and I read them. I don't have as much time to read them as I used to, but I still collect them. And, you know, just have them around so when I have a free minute, I can just go through them. It's such a great world. It's such an incredible world, and just a fantastic world where anything can happen. And even now, especially more so, comic books are aimed towards adults. The writing is much more sophisticated along with the art. And they're just a great, fun, energetic read.
You know, both Spider-Man and Undercover Brother have like dual identities, secret identities. What appealed to you about the idea of a secret identity?
Well, I think, you know, there's something great about the idea of having a secret life, an other life. You know, I think all of us have our secret lives. There are things that we do at home, things that we do in private that we don't let other people know about. And there's something very exciting about that, even on the small scale, about doing things outside of the group consciousness, how we act and how we are perceived outside versus how we really feel about ourselves or what we do in private. So, you know, I don't think it's an accident that, you know, from the very beginning, people like Superman, heroes like Superman or even The Shadow, have these secret identities, and the early innovators in comic books were really tapped into this idea of the everyman walking around being treated one way, but you know what, if we could just go into a phone booth and strip off our outer clothing and take off, say, our glasses, which are sort of this great icon for the thing that makes us normal. You know, we can't even see very well, but we take those glasses off, we take off our sort of dull clothing, and we are these super people. That's one level of it. And just the idea of having a secret from other people is such a fun and fantastic idea that I think all of us sort of gravitate towards that concept.
It's funny, though. If for some people, I think the secret identity is the opposite of the superhero identity, that in public you seem strong and okay and aware of things and interesting, and then in private you're falling apart and you feel weak. Don't you think that that's the secret identity for a lot of people?
I think it's what the true self is. There's a thing called the Batman-Superman dilemma, and this is something usually only people who are really into comic books really know about. Superman is always Superman, but he has to disguise himself as Clark Kent.
Right.
So he's always truly Superman, whereas Batman is actually always Bruce Wayne. He's not a hero until he puts on his his Batman outfit. And so there's a question of which is which.
Which is the real identity.
Which is the real identity and which is the false identity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the question. You know, if somebody is really strong in public and they break down in private, which are they truly? Are they always that strong person, but they happen to break down occasionally in private? Or is it someone who's really weak and who's really small on the inside, but when they go out in public, they have to put on this front of being, I am a strong person, I am in control, have no fear, I'm here to save the day. And so that's a question that each individual has to ask themselves. What am I really? Am I a weak person presenting myself as a strong person, or am I a strong person, but occasionally I have to break down in private? That's for other people to decide on their own.
And which is undercover brother? what's his real nature and which is assumed nature?
You know, that's a great question. I hadn't really thought about it, but as I look at what undercover brother is and what undercover is all about, and certainly there's an arc in the film where undercover brother, what he really says is that you just have to be true to yourself. There was a line in the movie where actually Sister Girl, she says to Undercover Brother, you know, I don't care about, I don't judge people on how they dress or what music they listen to. What I really care about is somebody being true to themselves. So if you're going to act this way or that way, that's fine, but just make sure you're doing it for your own reasons. And I think Undercover Brother, he is more than anything just a guy who's into his own funky self. As long as he stays true to his own funky self, then everything is fine.
John Ridley, he co-wrote the screenplay for the new film Undercover Brother. It's based on his web-based animated series of the same name, which you can find at urbanentertainment.com. We'll talk about his new novel in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Ridley talks about his new novel, A Conversation with the Man. It's about an African-American comic in the 60s who becomes the opening act for the Rat Pack. And music critic Myla Miles reviews a new compilation of outsider music. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and novelist John Ridley. His movies include Undercover Brother and Three Kings. He's been a producer of the TV series Third Watch and wrote for the sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Ridley started his career as a stand-up comic. Now he has a new novel about an African-American comic trying to make it in the 60s during the Civil Rights Movement. He opens for the Rat Pack in Vegas and becomes the first black comic on The Ed Sullivan Show. The comic is named Jackie Mann, and the novel is called A Conversation with the Man. John, really, tell us a little bit about the character, a little bit more about the character of Jackie Mann.
Well, Jackie Mann is a guy who's really in search of self. He lives during the... He's born in the 1930s during the Depression and has his rise to what prominence he has in the middle 1950s. And Jackie is a guy who doesn't want to be treated as most black people are treated at that time. And he gets it in his head that, you know, people who, black people who are celebrities, who are athletes, are much more accepted by white society. He sees them on television. He sees them at sporting events. He sees white people around them and near them, as he likes to put it, within touching distance of each other, which is sort of the highest level of acceptance in his mind for black Americans. And so he sets out on this journey. He says at the very beginning of this book, I just want to be famous. I want to be famous so that I can be accepted. But his quest for fame ends up chipping away at himself, at what he is, at how he thinks about himself, at how he's perceived by people who are close to him, his friends and his family. And the question becomes, what's more important, to be accepted by the community at large but have no self-esteem? Or is it better to feel good about yourself, to believe in yourself, but have to live a life of struggle because other people look down on the choices that you make in life? And that's Jackie's quest.
I'm going to ask you to do a reading from the early part of the book, and this is when the comic Jackie Mann is talking about the early days of Vegas when he's performing there.
It was 1959, and the only difference between Las Vegas, Nevada, and Birmingham, Alabama, was that down south they posted signs telling a black man where he couldn't go and what he couldn't do. Whites only. Coloreds not allowed. In Vegas, you had to figure that out on your own. You figured it out quick style. Stay off the strip. Stay on the west side. Stay the hell away from their casinos. Didn't matter how well you did in the showroom. Didn't matter how much the audience laughed or clapped or how many bows you took. Out there, it was still 1959, and out there, blacks weren't welcome. Not to stay overnight, not to eat, not to gamble. More than anything in the world, I wanted to gamble. Not for the jazz of laying a bet or the sake of wagering money. What I wanted was to stand at a table with all those people, suited men, ladies in their best dresses, living high and living fast and living cocktail society. I wanted to see them do a Red Sea part as I made my way to the roulette table and listen to all their star-struck bits. Great job tonight, Jackie. Heck of a show, Jackie. Don't know when I cracked up as much. Would you mind saying hello to the Mrs. Jackie? She's such a big fan of yours. It would mean so much. I wanted them to fawn and gush and throw me their love, same as they threw it at me when I was performing, when I was standing 3 feet above them. I wanted them to accept me. Accept me? They couldn't even see me. I got paid nearly $1,000 a week. I got pulled back on stage, do more time by the biggest stars alive. I got standing O's. And when it was all over, I got sent out the back door. You know what went out the back door? Trash went out the back. Stinking garbage and rotting food and black comics got sent straight to the alley, never mind how well they'd just done in the showroom.
That's John Ridley reading from his new novel, A Conversation with the Man, about a fictional stand-up comic named Jackie Mann. You must have heard great stories about the early days of Vegas, and particularly interesting what it was like for African-American comics then when the place was still pretty segregated.
Yeah, it was amazing because in Vegas, during its early days, it became such a mecca for live stage entertainment. I mean, everybody went there, from the biggest acts to the wildest acts like Louis Prima. Even Noel Coward did an amazing run at the Desert Inn. I mean, he was this very genteel, very sophisticated playwright who just, I mean, did incredible box office there. So everybody played there, and certainly the biggest black stars, Nat King Cole, Pearl Bailey was there, Harry Belafonte, but they could not stay in the casinos. There was a part of town called Westside. It was just a very rundown part of Vegas where all the black entertainers had to go and stay at a boarding house that was really kind of a rundown boarding house. And not only was it run down, but the woman who ran it actually charged the black entertainers more than they would have had to pay if they could have stayed on the Strip. So you even have black people back then taking advantage of the segregation. But there was one story, it was, I think it was Nat King Cole, who went out, was actually allowed to stay in a casino at one point, but was not allowed to fraternize with a lot of the white patrons there. And one day he just said, you know, to heck with it, I'm going swimming in the swimming pool. He jumped in the swimming pool. You know, in his mind, he said, you know what, I'm integrating the pool. I don't care what anybody says. And after that, the white patrons, they complained, and they had to drain the entire pool. Took all the water out of the pool after Nat King Cole went in it and filled it up again with water because the white whites who were staying at the casinos back at this time did not want to go into a pool, did not want to share the water with a black man.
Who'd you hear the story from?
It was documented in a couple of books that I read about the Rat Pack, because when Frank Sinatra started performing at the casinos, he was, believe it or not, Frank Sinatra was incredibly tolerant of racism. He could not stand racism and bigotry. Even though this is an Italian guy who hung out with a lot of the mob, who are notorious for looking down on black people, Frank could not stand racism whatsoever. And when he started staying at the casinos, started doing the Rat Pack shows with Sammy Davis Jr., he insisted, Sammy can stay in the casinos with me. He's going to be treated just like any other performer. Frank Sinatra in his day was the biggest entertainer in show business, and Frank's word was the law. And because of that, a lot of black entertainers who were good friends with Frank Sinatra started being treated just like a lot of the white entertainers. And believe it or not, Frank Sinatra is credited with breaking down a lot of the racial barriers in Las Vegas.
It must have been interesting for you to write about this era when comics were aspiring to, you know, play these big nightclubs like the Copa. And there were, you know, there were clubs in the East Coast and the West Coast and Florida that were these big, glamorous places. I mean, now if you're a comic, you're likely to spend years on the comedy club circuit. But, you know, there was a sense of glamour then. Are you sorry at all that you missed that, or do you not feel like you would have fit into the kind of glamour scene anyways?
Well, it's very weird because I certainly miss... I feel like I missed out on something, because you read about these places, you hear stories about it, you hear other entertainers talk about this age where, you know, men and women, they actually got dressed up. They went out. It was a big night for them. It wasn't just, oh, I'm going to put on blue jeans and a sweater and go to a club or something. It was a big night, you know, for parents, for adults to get away from their kids for a while, to have a really good meal, to have a couple of cocktails, and sit back and either listen to a huge comic, a very famous comic, or someone like Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin, or to see Martin and Lewis on stage. And we look back, or certainly I look back on that time as being a wonderful time. But at the same time, you know, certainly if I was a black guy back then, you know, I couldn't get into these clubs. I wouldn't be seated at these clubs. There was no way I could go in and see this entertainment, no matter how badly I wanted to.
Now, Jackie Mann is a comic who's, through most of the book, moderately successful, or, you know, pretty successful, really. But he's still mostly an opening act. He hasn't found his voice during most of the book. He's funny, but he's funny in the way that all the other comics are funny. And I hope I'm not giving away too much here, that it's not until he really finds his voice as an African American, being different from the other white comics, that he really establishes who he is as an artist. How did you imagine his material during both parts of the book?
Well, one of the things I really wanted to talk about with Jackie Mann, and I wanted to make this a very all-encompassing story about a time and a place, not just about race relations, but the changes that were going on in America and the changes that were going on in entertainment. And there was a divide in that period of time between the majority of comics who had come out of the vaudeville era, who were just telling very generic jokes about you know, mother-in-laws or their wives or things like that, and the birth of a new kind of comic who was a social commentator, someone who was talking about what was really going on in the world, people like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, people who had a particular point of view. And for Jackie, it's about making a choice between being just a very know-nothing, say-nothing comic, a guy who's funny, a guy who's a personality who can get over it because he's telling the audiences exactly what they want to hear, or taking another path and saying things that are very sharp, very pointed, that only a guy like Jackie Mann, a guy who grew up black in America, a guy who grew up in Harlem, a guy who grew up being slightly oppressed, or actually very oppressed in his day and age, who has a particular point of view, saying things that nobody else is saying, and having a voice, but rising above the din, rising above the sort of dull noise that's out there, and really taking a stand in terms of how he thinks and how he feels. But is that going to hinder his growth as a comedian? Because a lot of people may be turned off by what he's saying, people in power, guys like Ed Sullivan. It's a really difficult choice, but that's part of the struggle that Jackie goes through of what he is and what he stands for and what he's going to say.
My guest is John Ridley. He has a new novel called A Conversation with the Man. He also wrote the screenplay for the new film Undercover Brother. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Ridley, co-wrote the screenplay for the new action comedy Undercover Brother. He also has a new novel called A Conversation with the Man. It's the story of an African-American comic trying to make it in the 60s. Your new novel is about what this comic faces as an African-American in show business. You were a stand-up comic in the early part of your career before you became a writer. Yeah. Do you think that the issues for you were any different as a black comic than the issues for your counterparts who were white?
No, in some ways I don't think they were. I think there was still a difference between comics who had a particular point of view, were very pointed, who were social commentators, and the comedians who were just commentating on very generalistic things.
Airplane food,
you know, TV commercials. What we used to call them were the "Have you ever noticed" comics, because they would always start a joke. Have you ever noticed on TV commercials people are always saying this kind of thing. And comedy, unfortunately, when it became very explosive, when there was the big comedy boom in the early 1980s, there were so many people who just said, "Hey, you know what? I'm kind of funny. You know, I've been funny at office Christmas parties. Let me try being a comedian." And it really diluted the mix. And you would go to comedy clubs in strip malls. You know, I mean, literally in malls on corners in suburbs, and they would have comedy clubs there, and they just have people who became headliners, became the main focus of the show, the person that most people went to pay to see, who hadn't been comedians for a long time, who stole a lot of their jokes from, you know, what Leno or Letterman might have been doing the night before on television, and comedy just really got watered down. And I think that was more of a problem during the era that I was doing comedy, because we already had guys like, you know, Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy and Chris Rock was out there, and they were doing some very pointed comedy. But by and large, comedians, I think, weren't really saying anything, didn't have a point of view, and that's what people were seeing, and that's what they started expecting, was just sort of the ha-ha comedians.
Did you find your point of view as a comic?
Well, ironically, I think I found my point of view as a comic, but by the time I found it, I was already a writer, and I started writing. I was writing on television. I had started writing my first few novels, and I found that I could really use my voice more effectively in longer formats, and I was more free to write, especially writing the novels, and I became less interested in doing comedy. In some ways, I actually found the audience getting in my way, because there were things that I wanted to say that didn't necessarily have a punchline to them, didn't necessarily have a joke at the end. But when you're a comedian, you always have to end with a joke. Otherwise, you're just a guy standing on stage ranting. And the guys who book you in the clubs, they're not going to pay you to stand there and rant. They want to hear jokes. So once I found my voice, I found that I had outgrown stand-up comedy, in essence.
What would you say race relations are like now in Hollywood, in for movies and TV?
Well, I think in terms of myself, someone who's working behind the camera, someone who develops stories and projects for the studios, I think race relations are great. I had a terrific development season this year. I was working on 3 different pilots for 2 different networks. Both those shows featured a lot of minority talent in front of the camera. In fact, we're very heavily populated with Asian American talent, which you don't see a lot of. I had no problems with the studio, with the networks in terms of development, in terms of how I put the show together, what the storylines were like, in terms of the casting. I think people in Hollywood are incredibly open-minded in terms of race. And I think we're myopic in terms of how we look at the world completely. You know, we think everything, all the actors need to be young and beautiful. And if you're 35, you know, in television shows now, the elder statespersons on shows tend to be like 35-year-olds. You know, that's our version of being full-on adults. But I think in terms of the real power structure, when you look at the entire media corporations that really do run the show, I think they still have very narrow focus in terms of what they want to sell to the world.
This must be an interesting time to be writing for television. I'm thinking in part that there's a lot of pressure now on the networks to hire more African-American writers so that there's more more kind of truthful, accurate storytelling in sitcoms. And there's been a lot of pressure from the black community on TV to make sure that that happens. So as a black writer working in part in television, how's that affecting you? And is that are you enjoying having, you know, being black at a time when there is that pressure for more inclusion? Or does that kind of make things a little odd for you as well?
Well, I think the real problem is, yes, you're absolutely correct. There is a lot of outside pressure to change the structure behind the camera, to get more people of color working behind the camera. I think, unfortunately, the people who are raising these issues are actually going about it the wrong way because they're attacking the networks and the studios. And technically, the networks and studios do not hire the writing staffs that populate the television shows. It's actually other writers. It's the people who are called showrunners. The people who are the executive producers of television shows, the writer-producers. It's not hard to find good writers of color or of different gender or different age groups if you look for them. There are so many writers out there. It's sometimes hard to get scripts from people who might be good but don't have agents or are not well represented by their agents. You know, a lot of time agents, they don't think outside of the box either. Their job is to get their writers shows, to get them work. And if somebody is black and they could get on a show that maybe on UPN because it's a show that's targeted towards a minority audience, they may think, well, let me just put this writer on this show because I know I can get them a job, but I might not be able to get them a job on Frasier. So maybe they don't send that script to a writer who's an executive producer at Frasier. So there's an executive producer who may be willing to hire a black writer for a show which could be called a white show. And the fact of the matter is, in Hollywood, we do segregate our shows. We have white shows, we have black shows, and that's the way we talk about them. So unless that agent gets that script to a showrunner on Frasier, there's a black writer who may not get a job. It's very important outside of the studios, outside of the networks, these individuals or these groups or organizations that are picking on the networks and studios, they have to understand that you have to go other places and admonish other people, the writer producers, the agents, and make sure that they get the scripts out so that diversity can grow from a more organic place.
Well, John Ridley, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
John Ridley is the author of the new novel, A Conversation with the Man. He also co-wrote the screenplay for the new action comedy, Undercover Brother. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles on a new collection of outsider music. This is Fresh Air. We've come to think of outsider art as embracing the self-taught, the mentally unstable, and the religious visionary. Now there's outsider music. Music critic Milo Miles says this cluster of unconventional sounds doesn't add up to much.
Okay, Aunt Jemima, just roll me onto the stage in this trash can. I'm standing in a trash can. Think about you as the neighbor's cat goes by.
Kitsch Cool lives again, this time in the form of outsider music. Outsider music is the third part of what I call the Kitsch Trilogy. The first part happened nearly 10 years ago with the revival of so-called lounge or space-age bachelor pad music. Then, about 4 years later, came the fad for swing music done by saxophone-blowing youngsters in 40s drag. Now we have outsider music. In the recent music issue of the New York Times, an article by Dwight Garner codified the whole phenomena of outsider music and laid out the best case for it I have ever seen. As Garner put it, outsider music includes a patchwork of styles made by eccentrics, mental patients, self-taught loners, and visionary cranks, and, we might add, various amateur musicians. The pioneering outsider music expert is Erwin Chusid, the record producer and music historian whose Incorrect Music Hour has run for years on New Jersey station WFMU. In Garner's article, Chusid says, "Being an outsider musician is not an aspiration. As soon as you try to make outsider music, you're not. So, outsider music does not include crazy novelty records or works by musicians who are deliberately being primitive."
The city's very clean, you see. The people welcome you and me. It is a home away from home. It's Canada.
Like lounge and swing, outsider music is being presented as a new kind of cool, a counteractive to the processed, market-tested pop mainstream. I argue, however, that outsider music is just more kitsch that leads nowhere, and it encourages people to confuse oddity and novelty with originality. Outsider music can make good source material for adventurous regular musicians, but it's not very nourishing by itself. There are so many offbeat musicians who are not outsiders. Why turn to outsider sounds? I think it's out of voyeurism and because people like to snicker at them.
Oh, the rich people want what the poor people's got. And the poor people want what the rich people's got. And the skinny people want what the fat people's got. And the fat people want what the skinny people's got.
The idea is, you don't know if you are laughing at outsiders or with them. I think a lot more laughing at, not so much laughing with. If Chusid's definition is valid, outsider musicians do not think their work is laughable. Often the works are merely obsessive rituals that no audience can ever understand. Other flawed comparisons are made, too. Garner draws a comparison between outsider music and the peculiar blues and hillbilly tunes Harry Smith collected for his Anthology of American Folk Music. But Smith's eccentric numbers from the 1920s sound strange because they are far removed in time and culture, not because the performers are inept or mentally unstable. Many were amateurs, but they were plainly talented in a conventional sense. This brings us to Daniel Johnston, the Texas performer often cited as the best and the only semi-famous outsider musician. Johnston has recorded hundreds of his songs at home on cassettes in between stays in mental hospitals for manic depression. He has a career of sorts, has appeared on MTV, and had one of his songs recorded by Pearl Jam. This cover version of his tune Speeding Motorcycle by Mary Lou Lord was featured on an ad for Target department stores.
Speedy motorcycle of my heart. Speedy motorcycle always changing me. Speedy motorcycle, don't you drive recklessly. Motorcycle of my heart.
Sounds pretty much like a charming regular song, right? In fact, Johnston's appealing material is always his most conventional. Audiences share his fascination, sorrows, and happiness just as they would any other performer's. That's just the point. His outsider qualities are what you have to get past to appreciate him. Daniel Johnston may have recorded his material in an outsider way, but his best works show insider skills.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. He reviewed songs in the key of Z on Gammon Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Judy Garland. She was born 80 years ago today. From the soundtrack of the film A Star Is Born, here she is singing The Man That Got Away.
The night is bitter, the stars have lost their glitter, the winds grow colder, suddenly you're older, and all because of the man that got away.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett, available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. And Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of American Chica, Two Worlds, One Childhood by Maria Rana, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Palestinian writer and human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh. He started keeping a journal of life in Ramallah during the Israeli incursion. Also, we talk with Israeli historian Michael Oren. He's just written a new history of the Six-Day War. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.